Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to be speaking to Dr. Janet Lewis about her book titled How Insurgency Begins, Rebel Group Formation in Uganda and Beyond, out in 2020 from Cambridge University Press. This book does a whole bunch of things, and most importantly, it tackles the question of how and why do rebel groups initially form? And this may, to people who don't study civil wars, sound like a question that, oh, well, we must already have an answer for. But actually, as those of us who do study civil wars know, this is actually something we don't necessarily have a lot of clarity around. We know a lot about kind of the types of issues that can cause grievances or can cause issues between communities. We know a lot about sort of how rebel groups organize and operate, but sort of that turning point, how do you go from there being some sort of issue that maybe violence is going to be used to try and affect change about to an actual organized rebel group? There's some work to be done. And thankfully, Janet has done a lot of that work and helped us figure that out to understand kind of this transition process, which is murky and tricky. And I'm really impressed by how clearly, Janet, you've been able to investigate this. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to the podcast to tell us more about it.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Could you start us off before we get into the book to tell us a bit about yourself and explain kind of how you came to this topic and this book?
Sure. Well, let's see. I've had a long interest in intergroup conflict, right? With conflict and violent conflict in general, but also why it's so often defined by identity boundaries. I think it goes back to, as an undergrad, I studied abroad and lived in South Africa. I studied at the University of Western Cape, and I lived with a family there in the flats outside of Cape Town. And this was in the years immediately following apartheid in the late 90s. And also during that time, during summers in college, I worked at an organization that brought Israeli and Arab youth to the U.S. in a summer camp type setting. And so I was a counselor there. I ran a bunk of Israeli and Arab teenagers. And I taught them swimming and I worked with them on a ropes course. And through these experiences of just becoming close with people for whom identity-based conflict had so intensely touched their lives, that was really formative for me. You know, I should also note this was a time, this was the late 90s, so there had been a lot of identity-based conflict all over the world that had led to, you know, a lot of terrible violence. But I think there was also a time of relative hope that I was really attracted to. I'm someone, you know, very interested in preventing preventing conflict or ending violence before it gets really bad. And in that time, the Oslo Accords were not yet dead. Mandela was still president. And so at that sort of important phase of my life, I think I was really drawn to both the, you know, terrible things that could come out of identity-based conflict, but also the possibilities that it could be overcome, the sort of promise of resolving it. And then later on in grad school, I knew I wanted to return to research in Africa, and I I zeroed in on why some conflicts become violent, some don't. I'm a political scientist, so I tend to take a comparative perspective in my work. And I began by going to Uganda to get a start on studying that question. This was sort of early in my PhD program. And while I was in Uganda, again, with the aim of studying why some wars between non-state actors, rebel groups, and states, why some become so severe and some don't. But while I was there, I met with someone from Uganda's Amnesty Commission, and he gave me a list of people, because Uganda, I'll say more about this, I'm sure, as the conversation continues. Uganda's a place that's had a lot of internal warfare in its recent past, but has been pretty peaceful, which says lack of warfare since around about 2006. And while I was there talking to him, and I was focused in on the about five rebel groups, six rebel groups I knew of that had formed in Uganda, he gave me a list of people who had received amnesty from the government for being involved with rebel groups. And on that list, I saw more than a dozen groups I hadn't heard of. And I hadn't seen in our common data sets about civil war in Uganda, these rebel groups, but they were there. They had clearly existed. There were people who had been members of those groups and had gotten amnesty from the government. And I asked him, wait a minute, what are all these groups I've never heard of? He said, oh, well, they're not really important. They didn't become super violent. They got nipped in the bud early. And from there, I saw the political science literature and the broader sort of scholarship on conflict onset, we often call it internal armed conflict onset or civil war onset. I saw it in this new light. I realized that there were lots more instances of rebel group formation than we usually realize when we study these things retrospectively, and that a lot end early. And so that has a lot of fascinating repercussions for how we should even think about how conflicts begin. And I wanted to understand more about it. And that's how I came to study this topic and decided to write the book.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I think that sets up a lot of what the book does really well and kind of some of its broader themes in a sense. But before we kind of dive too much into the findings, which obviously I definitely have questions about, I want to think a little bit about kind of methodology, because as I sort of hinted at earlier, and as you've mentioned there, we do have lots of data sets. We do have lots of knowledge about civil wars. But actually figuring out, you know, the things that don't happen, the rebel groups that don't succeed, it's really hard to find out about that. And so I was wondering if you, given that you have figured out a way to do this, can you tell us a bit about kind of both the challenges of this sort of research, but also what your methods ended up being?
Sure, absolutely. Yes, that's right. Because it's kind of the fact that I decided to read this question, to study this question, and this realization that there were all these small rebel groups sort of begs the question of, like, wait a minute, why has no one studied this before? Why have we not focused on this before? And as you just noted, the answer is because it's really hard, right? And that's because rebel groups often form in areas where, very rural areas of low capacity states, sometimes known as weak states, by which I mean the state is not monitoring the territory very carefully. It's not very present in the sort of rural peripheral areas. This is, predominantly in, today in the global south, in poor lower income states. And so they're missing from a lot of these rebel groups, these small early failed rebel groups, are often missing from newspaper accounts of rebellion. And they don't really therefore make it much into a lot of the histories. They're not really in the data sets. Right. And so the biggest methodological challenge I faced was to go back and try to document some of these groups. And the short answer of how to do it was pretty straightforward, which is, I started with this list of groups of I came to understand them as potential groups that the government had identified. And then I went back and retraced them in the localities where they had purportedly began. So a couple of important points here. First of all, the government's list of groups was a little bit too long, which is to say something somewhat unusual about Uganda is that they have this blanket amnesty law for former rebels. So that meant that, that incentivized people to put down their arms and to gain sort of legal amnesty from the government from any rebellion they had engaged in. But it also meant that there could have been the potential for people to exaggerate rebellions where they hadn't really existed, right? In order to get amnesty, and I should say as part of the amnesty package was a couple of $100s as, you know, to help incentivize people to come forward and put down their arms. Right, so there's some risk that there's some rebel groups counted there that were not real. And the Uganda government also felt that it was good publicity for them to be able to perhaps inflate the number of rebel groups that they had put down. So I wanted to not take that number at face value. So I went to each of the localities, as I said, where the rebel group had purported to start, to talk to people there. And, you know, perhaps not surprisingly, but if you go to the communities where rebel groups had purportedly formed, people there, and I should say these events were happening 10, 15, maybe in some cases 20 years prior to when I was doing my research, people there remembered what had happened, right? Adults who are old enough could tell you if there was a real rebel group, who was involved with it, what happened, right? And as well as local journalists who are old enough to remember. So I could go back, and this was a really interesting process of getting to travel around Uganda and make connections with, you know, local leaders, local journalists, often who were affiliated with a local radio station, and gain basic information about whether or not a rebel group had really existed and what were the basic events that occurred around any rebel groups that did form. And, you know, I think so it's important to note that a lot of these rebel groups, you know, they did commit some violence. Like, it kind of begs the question, were these groups really important to understand? If they were small, they ended early, you know, who cares, right? They were often still very scary, unpleasant things for the people who lived around them. And importantly, some of those groups did go big, right? And if they were not nipped in the bud, as the government officials there would often say, right, they would go on to become quite severe conflicts. And so part of the reason to retrace both those that end early and those that get big is to be sure we're looking at the full landscape of how these kinds of conflicts get started. And lastly, I'll just note that, you know, what we typically do, at least in political science, is use data sets that only count rebellions if they resulted in some, you know, fairly substantial number of deaths, which is really quite reasonable for a lot of questions about conflict, right? But if you really want to get at how they start and why many fail, you need to look at, you know, not only those that go on to kill 100 or so people, maybe even 20, 30 people, you need to look at those who end before they even get to that point.
Mm. Thank you for taking us through that. I think there's a whole bunch of methods in there that I think might be useful for other things, but it's also useful to think about within this context of civil war studies, because some of these are, as you said, sort of a bit unusual, right? We are used to kind of having a minimum threshold of death, and that's great a lot of the time. But this is a great example of how we kind of can't just do that without thinking about it. So thank you sort of for giving us that basis to then get into your actual argument. So I have a bunch of kind of questions to pick apart pieces of your argument and ask you to give us more detail about them. But maybe before we do that, could you just kind of state very briefly sort of what is the thing that you found?
Sure, absolutely. I'll focus on, there's several different questions that the book addresses. I'll focus on what I think is probably the most important, which is why among rebel groups that form, only some become viable. And in doing that and answering that question, I can tell you some of the basics of also how they form. And this is, I should say, the book focuses really exclusively on the kind of weak state context that I just described, right, where the state has a low capacity to monitor its particularly rural peripheral areas. And in those contexts, I find that rebel groups often start small because they can, right? There's low barriers to entry, right? So these are not groups that start with some large group of people and some huge upswell of frustration and protest necessarily, right? Because they don't need to. Just a small number of people can get one of these rebel groups started, right? But this has all kinds of implications for what the start actually looks like in practice. I mean, in particular, it means that these groups that are small when they start are quite vulnerable, right? Even if the state has a generally low capacity to monitor its territory, if it does learn about a non-state organized group forming on its territory that plans to challenge its authority, right, they will go after it. And even if their military is not, you know, particularly large or high capacity, right, they would certainly have the capacity to end this kind of small nascent group. Right. So this puts information at the center of what happens to rebels. And so, you know, in a nutshell, if the government finds out about the rebels, they will be able to end them. And therefore, what becomes very crucial to the answering the question of why only some groups become viable, the answer is, does the government find out? And it turns out that puts civilians at the center of the story, because civilians, that is the ones who are local to, close to where rebel groups form, right? Those are the ones that are going to learn some basic information about who the rebels are, where they go at night, where they do their training, right? And so whether or not this group of local civilians tells the government who that a rebellion is happening and where they are and who they are, that really determines whether or not groups survive. That's the core of the argument. And then there's a lot of other interesting pieces about what that means for how rebels use violence and what that means for about these ethnic makeup of the communities and what that might have to do with whether or not these rebels get off the ground.
So that's exactly what I want to sort of dig into. So thank you for giving me such a good opening to start to go into the pieces of that argument. Let's talk about deploying violence. How does this kind of reliance on nearby civilians to, in the very least, not go straight to the government, how does that impact how these nascent groups think about the use of violence?
Absolutely. Yeah, the big picture idea is that they use violence very carefully, right? Because what these civilians think about them really matters. And I argue that most civilians, and of course there are exceptions, and we should talk about that. And I think we will as the discussion continues. But typically, civilians are, we could think of them as somewhat neutral to a new rebel group and willing to follow them if they think they're going to be reasonably competent and or just. And this is tough to pinpoint, but the general idea is that even a person who happens to be very anti-government is not likely to support a rebel group if they think the rebels are going to be incompetent or terrible in some way, right? And by the same token, someone who is, sort of neutral or even supportive of the government might want to get behind a rebel group if they think they are going to be quite competent or do really great things for their community, right? And so there's sort of, it's not really predetermined what civilians will think of them, and civilians are trying to understand what's going on if they start seeing violence occur in their midst. And rebels know that. And so rebels are committing violence with the aim, typically, of scoring easy wins, right? So we could expect violence to be very small scale. I should say also rebels, they do need, they're often resource poor early on. So they need, for example, to capture some weapons. So they may, if there's a police detached, a few policemen walking around in the night on patrol, that would be a good target for a new rebel group, right? Because it would be easy to overpower those just, you know, two or three police officers, gain their weapons and equipment, right? But also then spread the word to the community, you know, hey, there's something starting here and we are really quite competent. Here is evidence of that, right? And it's and the rebels have very much in mind, you could think of it as the optics of their early violence, right? The rebels also have not yet perhaps set up good intelligence structures in a community right off the bat. And so they're also still trying to figure out which civilians might be for or against them. And so you don't see the kinds of terrible violence against civilians that you often see later on in the insurgency. Typically, you see more sort of pacific behavior towards the civilians as rebels are trying to win them over, and very careful small-scale violence meted out against the government that generally demonstrates, again, their competence.
Mm. And I thought this is a particularly key finding because it sort of pushes back against one of the assumptions that I think we often see in news reports of kind of, oh, well, the violence is small because they're just not very good at it, or the violence is small because they don't have the capacity to it. And that if they had more people or had more weapons, whatever, or, you know, had more skill, they would indiscriminately kill a lot of people. And maybe that's true in some instances, but I think what I really appreciated from this sort of investigation is that you give us sort of more options and more tools to understand what might be going on, and in a lot of ways kind of give the nascent rebel group more agency and rationality than sort of hysteric news reports might.
Yes, absolutely. And it's also actually part of the reason it's interesting, you know, that rebels aren't often, or we see pretty commonly them not, you know, sort of announcing, I should say, while they are whispering to the local civilians, they're not announcing often to the national news, hey, this was us, right? They're trying to slowly spread the word locally, but they might not want the national government to be certain that there's a new rebellion forming. They might want to, and these are communities often that, you know, suffer from banditry or, you know, other forms of criminality. And we see actually, you know, throughout history, a lot of cases of, you know, governments actually can't tell whether or not they are bandits at first, right? Or they're not sure, and the rebellion may not be broadcasting it in these early stages. But that actually exacerbates this problem of us having a hard time in retrospect studying these groups is yet another problem. While we also may miss these early phases often, we may see subsequent phases and we see rebels, you know, committing atrocities against civilians and assume that that's sort of how it was from the start, right? But because these actually very initial stages were quite hidden and intentionally on the from the standpoint of the rebels, from people beyond the local community. It's also another reason why it's so important for the local communities to be like sort of consulted, or for them to their stories about what happened in the beginning of the rebellion, that it's important that those are reflected in our collective retrospective understanding of what happened.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'm really glad that you explained that particular finding, because it does have some really, really important implications given our sort of current theory. one that I admit I've never been particularly satisfied with. So I was pleased to see this. And I'd love to kind of ask in a similar vein, sort of how do your findings kind of hold up against some other sort of known theories, right? You've mentioned a bit about kind of, oh, well, they're already mobilized against the government, therefore, right? But what about things kind of like terrain or proximity to borders or exclusion from politics or anything like that?
Sure. I'll actually take exclusion first and then come back to terrain and borders, just because since exclusion kind of relates to the maybe more commonly expected ethnic grievances type mechanisms. So one thing I think it's important to note is that sort of if a region was excluded from the central government and that was common knowledge and that was politicized, that clearly would only help a rebellion. And surely there's some cases where that happens, right? But the point I'm trying to make is that in at least a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, well, actually, let me back up and say first in Uganda, you know, I did my best at getting objective measures of exclusion and found that, you know, that particular argument just doesn't hold up, at least for that case, right? It's a case for which there's pretty good data on the ethnic background of people who were part of the cabinet in the years prior to or right around where the rebellions formed. And so it's pretty clear that there's no relationship between exclusion of ethno-regions and where ethno-regions either formed or became viable. again, I don't think it certainly wouldn't have hurt the rebels' case, but the point is that my argument suggests that a lot of what happens with the community frustration towards central governments, they come out of the violence of rebellion rather than preceding it, or at the very least they can, and that in ethnically homogenous contexts, right, those frustrations are more likely to be understood in ethnic terms. And therefore we might look back on some cases and kind of presume that ethnic grievances started the conflict, where in fact ethnic grievances came out of the conflict, right, especially if the governments come in, as they often do, with kind of ham-fisted counterinsurgency strategies and the government themselves gets involved in harming civilians, right? Of course, then ethnic grievances really get exacerbated by the course of a conflict. So I think that and hope that my findings just sort of put into context that you don't need to have widespread identity-based grievances to have conflicts that are retrospectively remembered as being really about ethnicity, right? And of course, some of the findings about kind of rumor in ethnic groups suggest sort of how narratives perhaps get spread and really crystallize better in homogenous contexts. Turning to some of the arguments about the sort of more classic arguments about, I'll take, say, terrain first. I think that in general, my approach of kind of turning the clock back on rebellions and looking at the very initial stages, they don't necessarily contradict those findings, say, about terrain. But they suggest that, and just to clarify for any listeners who might not be familiar with it, right, there's a sort of classic finding from Fearon and Leighton of a 2003 paper that countries with more rugged terrain are more likely to have more insurgency. And, you know, I found that rebel groups formed pretty much anywhere that was, and much more likely in rural areas, but it was not the case that they formed, you know, exclusively in the mountains. And so my findings kind of put some of those cross-national findings from Fearon and Leighton and others into context, which is that finding may hold at a cross-national, at a country level. But when you look within a country, rebels are really constrained by these information dynamics. And what they, you know, usually want most is to just, you know, feel that they will be able to survive a incubation period wherever they are. And for some rebels, that might be in the mountains. For others, it might be in their home community. For some, I found that, you know, if their home community was on, you know, near a border, they would set up shop certainly within closer to the border or within the more forested area within the general region that they knew best. So in a sense, by sort of both turning back the clock and studying it at a higher level of resolution, which is to say at the subnational level rather than the national level, I mean, we see that terrain, you know, certainly helps rebel groups, and some certainly flee to the mountains if they get pushed there. You know, borders, they would take advantage of them if they had access to them, but it wasn't their primary concern when they were getting off the ground. I think that a lot of those findings, this is true for a lot of findings in literature, they also hold for once the Civil War really gets going, right, which is what a lot of the prior literature is actually focused on. So once Civil War really starts getting going, borders are, you know, even more crucial for rebel groups because they have larger armies and they need to have a good fallback area, you know, similar role of mountains.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's definitely something that was important in one of the civil wars that I studied, which is Angola, where borders become incredibly important, but primarily in decade three of the conflict.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's a huge, huge part of the last decade of the war, but it's not such a big deal in the initial years. And so I was, again, another finding I thought was really interesting. But I do want to kind of turn away a little bit from sort of the implications for research, that there are loads of them and they're very interesting. This book also has some kind of obvious, but also some not so obvious implications for policy. So I was wondering if you could kind of walk us through what, you know, this better understanding, this more nuanced or, as you said, higher resolution understanding, what does this mean for policy?
Mm-hmm, sure. I think that, I agree with you. It's sort of obvious, it's sort of not, is that states who, you know, wish to, and I think really most do want, would want to end non-state armed groups that are going to challenge their authority, the states that want to end them early before they become quite violent, need to know about them. And they need to have deep ties in the community to get information from communities where threats may be emerging, right? Or this could be known as the informational penetration of the state. But in this very particular way, it's not just about like the community being legible or countable to a state, but it's about the state, you know, having people in the community that trust the state enough to share information with it. And, you know, so this has implications for community policing types of findings. And I think it has a lot of important implications for state formation, you know, especially in Africa, where we see in Rwanda, Uganda, Ethiopia, you know, much of Ethiopia's recent history, not the most recent chapter, even Eritrea, we see former rebels that have taken control of the states who understand this, right? In Uganda, the current president, Yoweri Museveni, has been in power for 36 years. He himself is a former successful rebel who succeeded in taking over the state. And as a former rebel, he's aware of the importance of local ties. And, you know, in that state, they've put in place a system of village councils, or really, I mean, a whole, you know, complex system of what it, on paper at least, is decentralized governments going down to the village level. But even at the very village level, there are representatives of the security apparatus whose role it is to share information up the chain if they detect important security threats emerging in the community. Right? And so the good news is that states like Uganda as well as Rwanda, you know, have not had a lot of rebel groups form on their territory since, as I mentioned, about 2006 in Uganda's case. Right? But then the dark side of this, of course, is how easy any of these tools can be, kind of easily they can be repurposed for sort of authoritarian ends, right? And to also monitor and perhaps stifle opposition political threats. And so I think this points to not only the importance of domestic intelligence, but also of accountability and oversight of those intelligence institutions to ensure that they don't become politicized. That I think is probably the most basic and clear policy implication that comes out of the book.
Well, and I thought that it raised a lot of links for me with sort of counterinsurgency doctrine about kind of, it's all about, I mean, hearts and minds is a headline term, but the kind of practical reasoning behind it is to get information, is for civilians to be willing to come forward with information. And this is, again, you know, something that's often thought about kind of in the midst of the conflict or trying to end a conflict. And so in a lot of ways, it's a very familiar policy suggestion, but deployed at a time that I think is not when it's usually deployed, which I think is kind of both in some ways makes it easier to think about putting into effect, but also is like stranger to comprehend because it's like, wait, but that's not how we're used to doing things. So I thought that was interesting. And I think there is probably something to be looked at in terms of kind of these countries that you've just named, many of which are ruled by, as you said, former rebels, right? Is there perhaps a correlation between countries that have figured out what these mechanisms are and can more effectively nip rebel groups in the bud for better or worse because they, you know, managed to avoid that themselves?
Yeah, right. No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think a lot of these countries, and there's some new exciting work on this that have formed out of rebellion, have actually been sort of relatively economically successful, relatively stable, right? I mean, if you look, Eritrea is an example, a clear example of becoming also highly repressive, right? I think there's a lot of concern about democratic backsliding in these countries, you know, in East Central Africa, where you have victorious rebels in power. And that happened, you know, even arguably in Ethiopia under the victorious rebels there from the 80s and 90s, the TPLF.
Well, I do want to kind of think about this idea of the implications, right, for states, because I really appreciated that the book doesn't just focus on Uganda, doesn't just focus on countries similar to Uganda. There are a number of sections that kind of discuss other things beyond that, you know, how Uganda is representative of other countries or what can we take from it. And I wanted to ask you in particular about kind of the implications for this argument and sort of the things we've been discussing. If we think about rebel group formation in states that, you know, for want of a better word, we might use the term stronger, that do have more, in the very least, police or informational capacity before conflict breaks out, how might we think about these things that you're coming up with in those sorts of contexts?
Sure, absolutely. Well, to return to something I said at the start of our conversation, you know, I talked about these in these weaker state contexts, right? Rebel groups start small because they can, right? Because the barriers to entry there are low, or there's not a lot of monitoring. You can get off the ground with just a small number of guys with a small number of weapons who don't have a lot of material endowments, who don't even have perhaps a lot of organizational endowments, although that wouldn't hurt, which is to say they do not necessarily already have to have come together under the sort of organizational umbrella of some form of nonviolent or even violent organization, former rebel group or so on. So the implication of that, the flip side, is that in stronger states, the barriers to entry are going to be much higher, and aspiring rebels are going to think much harder about starting, right? There'll be a selection process where the would-be weaker groups just won't risk it, right? And therefore, we should expect rebel group formation to be more rare in stronger states, right? That's pretty uncontroversial. But also we should expect them to have higher levels of endowments from the beginning, right? So you're not going to get started unless you're much less likely to risk it. That is, unless you already have, you know, access to a pretty substantial cache of weapons. Maybe you have access to through a prior organization, through a group of people that trust each other. Maybe that have some military skills. You maybe have access to financing. Right. And so you're just not going to dare to start unless you have those higher levels of endowments on average. Right. And also probably, you know, you're going to be ready to go or go big from the start in terms of your level of violence. Not always. Right. Of course, there are sort of urban terrorist groups and that be maybe something else. But groups that are really planning to challenge the territorial authority of a state are not going to go for it unless they're really quite strong. They may also only do it if they believe that, you know, have a strong belief that civilians in their area, or a stronger belief that civilians will be more predisposed to support them, right? And so, yeah, in stronger states, we should expect rebel group formation to be more rare, to become more violent more quickly, more likely to, you know, need the implosion of an existing security force, either the implosion or perhaps the just fragmentation, splitting apart of prior security forces or different security forces turning against one another, that is to say state security forces. Right. For example, I think you see that in Syria at the start of the Syrian civil war, right? You saw this more of what I think classic or what people typically coming from at least the US expect when they think of how civil wars start. You have this groundswell of civilian protest and then combined with the fracturing of the military. So you have some really, you know, true experts in organizing violence that are already somewhat pre-organized, forming a lot of what becomes the rebellion against the Assad regime. So that is, I think, the really key implication for rebel group formation in stronger states. And I think I know a lot of scholars, Irish Malone and others, who are starting to collect better data that will able to enable us to test that kind of claim in a broader set of cases than I was able to in the book. I explain some of these ideas and demonstrate them through some examples. And I think the next wave of research will hopefully be testing those claims even more broadly.
Well, before I get to the next wave of research, one more kind of, I guess, on this book. In the process of putting all this together, looking at the higher resolution data at the subnational level, and obviously talking to loads of people and skimming through goodness knows how many newspaper articles, was there anything in particular that sort of surprised you in the research or writing process?
Sure. Let's see. A couple things that surprised me. You know, in retrospect, maybe they shouldn't have, but there was, it was somewhat surprising me to sit down with former rebels and, to see just how, in a sense, relatable they were. Like, this is, you know, I am not someone, predisposed to violent action in any way. But these were people, you know, who, not all of them, but by and large, you know, were really quite personable, charismatic, worldly even. Several of them, you know, had even been to the U.S., one educated in the U.S. And so even though I was someone, arguably, you know, sort of predisposed to kind of strategic accounts of why violence occurs, it did really struck me. And as you sit down with people to hear them articulate why to them this was, you know, given the hand that they had been dealt in life, why this felt like collecting a group of people to challenge a state violently felt like the best option for them for personal advancement and to improve the standing of their community. And so those moments often felt a bit surprising when I realized just how relatable some of their stories were. And I also really just appreciated and was always somewhat surprised about how, no matter how far I was, you know, from a capital city out in rural areas, when I'd introduce myself to villagers and, you know, would try to be kind of mindful of any power dynamics that were there between them. And I tried to be extremely clear with the help of locals that they had no obligation to speak to me and that there was no direct benefit of them for speaking to me. And that my aim was, you know, going to be to help understand how insurgencies begin and what the experience was like for them. And I was going to try to bring that to an American audience, to American university students, to help educate Americans about what their experience was like, just how much they understood that and appreciated the value of that, and how willing they were to sit down with me and share their experiences with me. That was, you know, surprising in the best possible way.
Yeah, lovely surprise. Thank you for sharing that with us. That really just leaves my final question. You mentioned some kind of future research directions, but as we all know, all the things that could be done with a book, all the things that could be done next, does not necessarily mean that you as the author must do them all yourself. That would be A, exhausting, and B, like, let other people into the fun, right? So I don't want to presume what you're working on now or next, and maybe you could tell us a bit about it.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I think on Rebel Group Formation, I'm doing one paper on keying in a little more on what's going on with violence in the very early phases, trying to expand some of that chapter of the book in collaboration with a PhD student. I collaborate with Stephen Rangazis, who knows a lot about history. And so we're trying to understand, using historical cases, even more about how people perceive early violence. That's one project. And another project I'm really excited about is on the topic of how networks in rural villages shape people's beliefs and understandings, trying to apply some of those ideas to how host communities in rural areas relate to refugees, and whether and how good perceptions of other groups like refugees may spread through social networks. So I've been piloting some of that work, actually back in rural Uganda, with my co-author, Jennifer Larson.